Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
You have just stepped over from Season 2 to Season 3 of The Twilight Zone.
I'm sorry. We don't have any vacancies. When will we?
There are no longer any armies. Only rags of various colors. There are no more boundaries, governments, or noble causes. Therefore, no reason to fight you.
We're the best. Wait a minute, Jesse. Before you shoot, think of this. Shoot that ball, and you may win more than you bargained for.
There's nothing you can say that will stop me. Nothing.
I'm sorry. I was required to say that.
You're a bad man! You're a very bad man!
You're so ill, but you're gonna be all right now.
A funny thing happened to me on the way over to the club tonight. I met this broad. Jerry, you don't mean broad. You mean lady.
For the orphans, you know. But it's early, and we've only just started. Down for business! Down for business! Down for business!
Mr. Chambers, don't get on that ship! Rest of the book, to serve men, it's a cookbook!
You're in luck. Something just opened up.
Hello, folks. My name is Lynn, and as always, I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone, but I am not alone. I'm joined by my superb co-hosts, Bobby Neer, Robert, and Dave. Hello, guys. How are you?
Hey, fine. Thank you.
Well, at least we got
more than two in this room tonight. So
yes,
good.
We do. Yes, we do. It's wonderful. Well, it's only 22 days until Christmas. Do you guys realize that? 22 days. So, luckily, I have finished all my Christmas shopping, and the only gifts I have left to buy are some yummy treats for the adorable little pooches who live in our apartment building, one of which Bobby and I are pet-sitting for this weekend, delightful little white Maltese named Tori, and she has a tendency to bark when she hears noises outside in the hallway. So, luckily, one of our wonderful neighbors has agreed to watch her during our taping of the show. So thank God for neighbors. You know, that's one little Christmas gift we have here, too. So with that being said, our episode today is simply called Two.
And now, Mr. Serling.
This is a jungle, a monument built by nature honoring disuse, commemorating a few years of nature being left to its own devices. But it's another kind of jungle, the kind that comes in the aftermath of man's battles against himself. Hardly an important battle, not a Gettysburg or a Marne or an Iwo Jima. More like one insignificant corner patch in the crazy quilt of combat. But it was enough to end the existence of this little city. It's been 5 years since a human being walked these streets. This is the first day of the sixth year, as man used to measure time. The time, perhaps 100 years from now, or sooner. Or perhaps it's already happened 2 million years ago. The place, the signposts are in English, so that we may read them more easily. But the place is the Twilight Zone.
It is simply called Two, and it stars a very young Charles Bronson and Elizabeth Montgomery. And this episode takes place in a war-torn city of weeds and rubble lying dormant from the effects of this war. Two uniformed strangers, a man and a woman, wander the streets searching for food, when they come face to face with each other. Their uniforms indicate that they fought on opposite sides of the war. The woman starts to attack the man. A very physical fight ensues, and he ends up knocking her unconscious. He proceeds to eat some of the delectable-looking canned chicken parts that the woman found. Good. The man wants nothing more to do with war or fighting. And he proceeds, you know, to eat the chicken and walk the streets. And he wants peace. You know, he tries to get this through to the woman after he revives her and gives her the rest of the chicken to eat. Now, she can't speak English, and her deep-seated hatred for the opposite side is very obvious, and she's wary of every move this man makes. But yet, she follows him around. She follows him all over. And after he shows her an act of kindness by pulling a dress she was admiring off of the mannequin and giving it to her, she ends up shooting at him. Luckily for him, she misses him, and he walks away from her in disgust. Well, the next morning, she finds him again. And he screams at her to go away, get out of here, I don't want you around. But she looks at him with these apologetic eyes, and she looks so sympathetic. And she's wearing the dress she described as Prokrasny. Realizing that there's hope, a little bit of hope anyway, he forgives her, and the two walk off together into the unknown. Well, Elizabeth Montgomery was quoted as saying that the making of this episode was creepy. In an interview conducted by The Hollywood Reporter after filming was completed, she said, "I couldn't help thinking what it would be like if I went around the corner and there actually wasn't anyone there, nothing but rubble, grass growing in the streets, the debris of a dead human race." So creepy is a good word to use for this episode. Liz Montgomery's words could be echoed by any one of us at any time, especially over the last 60 years. City, state, country, and even world annihilation has been a very real fear for a very long time. And Rod Serling, being the visionary that he was, he knew that this was the case, which is why he wrote stories such as Time Enough at Last and The Shelter, and why he approved the story written by Montgomery Pittman. I mean, you've got a man and a woman on opposite sides, and they meet amidst the world's destruction and devastation. But somehow they know they need each other. There's no way of knowing if anyone else is alive out there or what might happen if they encounter these other people, if they're alive out there. But for this story, I guess we're to assume that these two are now the only ones left. But something that I found very interesting and well-placed in this episode happened when Charles Bronson left the restaurant after knocking Liz Montgomery unconscious. She did have a stunt double, by the way, which is a good thing. But anyway, he started walking along the sidewalk, and when he stopped for a moment, a white dove flew out from behind him. A white dove of peace was a perfect symbol in this episode. A lot of people don't notice that. They say they never even noticed the dove fly out from behind him. And actually, I didn't notice it at first either. I think it was my third or fourth viewing of this episode years ago that I finally noticed that dove. But within this atmosphere of ruin where there seems to be almost nothing alive, we see that something else has survived. So this gave me the impression that they might not be the only humans to survive. So it was at that moment that he decides to go back and revive the woman. Not only did he feel the need to try and make peace, but I think he also realized that he was all alone, and this might be his only chance at some companionship. Because if you recall, right after he knocked her out and began eating that nauseating meat in a can, he looked at a photo of a bathing beauty on the wall calendar. And did you notice that he glanced back at Liz a couple of times? I mean, after all, you know, he was a man, so who knows how long it had been since he'd been around a woman or with a woman. So he couldn't help but notice that she was an attractive one, also with a good bit of fight in her. And she did handle herself pretty well. And although, but the funny thing was, and I also found this funny in the episode, although, you know, he slugs her unconscious, I mean, he just knocks her out with one gigantic punch. He's able to easily revive her just by throwing a little water on her, and then when she gets up, she has no bruises on her. So, you know, that's the wonderment of, you know, Rod Serling and, you know, editing and all that kind of thing. You know, don't put any bruises on her. but despite him belting her and her shooting at him, these two, who could barely communicate, realized that they needed each other and had to try rebuilding their lives together. So we're left to wonder if they ever encounter anyone else out there, and if they do, hopefully they'll all live together peacefully and start a new civilization. But just as her soon-to-be bewitched co-star Agnes Moorehead did in The Invaders, Elizabeth Montgomery was great because she had to pull off this entire episode with only facial expressions and mannerisms. She had only that one word of dialogue, Prokrasny. And Charles Bronson, he was very convincing in his role as a man who wanted nothing more to do with war and only wanted to survive. So I do believe that Rod Serling, you know, had a great idea here, you know, with this episode. And, you know, I know that some people loved it, some people hated it, but, you know, I thought it worked out well. But also, I do believe that Rod Serling gave the shortest closing narration ever in this episode when he said, "This has been a love story about two lonely people who found each other in the Twilight Zone." I don't think he's ever given a shorter closing narration than that. But my rating for this episode is a 4 for excellent. No supernatural or magical aspects to this one. A little bit of science fiction, I suppose. But I think it's a terrific episode, and it works. And I give it a 4 for excellent. So with that, I turn it over to Robert.
Thank you, Lynn. Yeah, since you said that was the shortest, just wait till it's a good life. Then you get the longest.
That's right.
Narration. That one. Yeah. It's without a doubt, if people read my review and know and heard the latest shows, that season 3 is one of my favorites of the Twilight Zone. Because I pretty much feel that it starts to hit its stride in this season. Probably better story writing or maybe a little more budget. I don't know. But growing up as a kid and seeing this story, it was one of my favorites. And compared to King 9 Will Not Return, most definitely a massive improvement over the first story of season 2. So, yeah, season 3, first story, wonderful. And, of course, you got two, you know, actors that are just coming into their own. You got Elizabeth Montgomery and Charles Bronson, two actors that kind of veered different paths when it comes to media. You have Bronson that kind of veers into movie roles, doing westerns, going into the Death Wish series. And then you got Elizabeth Montgomery taking the other path, going into TV-type movies like, you know, Lizzie Borden and marrying, or actually was a partner with Robert Foxworth, if you remember him, and Falcon Crest as Chase Gilberti. So,
oh, yeah.
They both took two separate paths, but what a great beginning for them to be in this story, and not going too much over what Lynn already went over with this story. One thing that I did notice about this, I may notice in my review that I thought I saw someone moving around by a truck behind her as she's walking, the Elizabeth Montgomery character. But
oh,
I
darn it. You
put
know
that
what?
Down.
I look for that.
I'm thinking
that, and I forgot to look. Darn.
I'm thinking that was missed in editing, because if you look at the truck window, you see movement there. Like maybe it was an extra, or maybe it was prop or something to do where they might have just missed that in editing.
I'm definitely going to look for that next time I watch this. I forgot all about that.
Also, her not talking per se, just using her facial expressions. Lynn said, wonderful. A way of how to express yourselves. I mean, there's been other movies where, you know, people are mute. We know that she can talk, but in a different language, so she's not, you know, naturally mute. But there are mute people that use facial expression to get their point across, which is wonderful. And you got the Bronson character, very much remnant of the Omega Man type alpha man in this story. What I was able to nail myself down on was it was probably either an American-German or a Russian-American war, if we go with the aspect that this is really Earth. Now, if you listen to Rod's opening narration, he kind of veers it into, well, it may be not Earth. He doesn't come out and say it's not Earth or it's a different planet or whatever, but, you know, people can take away from it what they will with it. Very much the first of apocalyptic type movies and shows that will later come out. So this kind of sets it up for disaster type films. I felt the story was very well done with it. I felt that this was basically, you know, if I would watch this with time enough at last. very much a flip side of a coin. On one side you get Time Enough Last, and on the other side you get this story too. So very much one that I enjoy watching, and it's not the kind that I mentioned where you watch it once in a while. You know, I think this has played a lot on the marathons. I'm not for sure because I hadn't watched a TZ marathon in a while.
Yeah, they do. They do play it, yeah. But can I ask you a question? When you say that you would go to the opposite side of the coin, are you saying because Time Enough at Last, you got one man who's all alone in total devastation? I mean, you know, there's nothing. And on the other side of the coin, you have at least two people that have companionship and have a chance to rebuild. Like Henry Bemis has no chance that you can see. He has no chance to rebuild a civilization or you know, a family or any other people. But on this episode, you have two people that can get a life started again.
Well, I definitely believe that, you know, with two, they, unless they find other people, will probably have their own lives. There's no way to know if they can have a baby because you don't know what weaponry was used.
Radiation.
It could be a different type of radiation. There's kind of radiation that leaves the buildings alone but destroys the organic or people. And then you could have one that is in reverse that could destroy buildings and maybe not harm the people as well, because you got to remember, if this is 6 years later, they would have been well dead by now from radiation poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
Or
exactly.
At least depending how far from the epithet that they were when the bombs went off. Also, they're using lasers for guns instead of bullets.
But at least they had each other, you know, like they had companionship, where that was the problem with Henry Bemis. He had nobody. He had nothing. And that's why he wanted to kill himself. You know, because he was all alone in the world.
Each of these stories, you only have 22 to 25 minutes to tell it.
Exactly.
So you don't have enough time to explore, because you generally watch these shows or films, there's always people underground during the time of war. And so I don't believe that Bemis is by himself, and I don't believe that these two are by themselves. I think eventually,
as
time goes on, that people will filter out. The old man in the cave is a great example later on. There's another situation with that where you have more than one or two people with that one. You have a group of people trying to survive.
I totally agree with you, because I can't believe that, not to get off on Time Enough at Last, but I can't believe that Henry Bemis was the only person in the entire world that at that time was down in the bank vault. Someone else might have been down in the bank vault too, or somewhere where he couldn't be killed. And the same with these two. I mean, are we to believe that they're the only two people walking? Why are they walking around? Somehow they survived, so other people may have survived. The Dubs survived, you know, so there is life somewhere, but there's not enough time to explore into that, yeah.
Perhaps best go to someone else and go back to him.
Okay, Bobby, you want to go ahead, and then we'll go back to Robert?
Yes, luckily I'm brilliant enough to cover for both of us, so... obviously, this is a quality episode, and it gets a lot of good vibes from people, but not everybody loves it, and there are some people who don't like it. Now, at IMDb, it gets nearly an 8 rating, and there were only 4 reviews there, and they're all very positive. However, we reviewed this episode on our board at our group back in August of this year, and then we ran a poll afterwards, and most people gave it either a 5 or a 4, but 2 of our members gave it a 2.5, which is slightly above average, and 1 of our members gave it a 1, and in her review called it one of the worst and said she puts it on when she wants to fall asleep. So not everybody loves this. As for me, if I remember correctly, I gave it a 4. I did not give it a 5. Because I do have some problems with it, and I don't think it's quite as good as it ought to be. And I would start with that by saying that I don't particularly like how the set looks. It looks too much like a movie set out of an old war movie, which it almost undoubtedly is. And after a devastating war like that, and after 5 years, I think it should look worse than that. And the biggest problem I have with it is that there's nobody around. There are no bones around or decaying bodies anywhere around, which is inconceivable. I mean, in today's world, in forensic medicine, they dig up bodies all the time to get evidence about crimes, and they don't open up graves and find that there's nothing there. So even after 5 years, there ought to be something around somewhere, and that's brought home when Bronson goes into that building there and he sees the skeleton of a dead bird in a cage. If there's a skeleton of a dead bird in a cage, there ought to be dead bodies outside too. So I think that takes a little bit away from it because it hurts the atmosphere. I also think that that Bronson and Montgomery look too good for people who have been wandering around for years and years after a war. They look perfectly healthy and well-fed. Now, and there's only so much you can do with actors to make them look bad, especially back 40 years ago, 50 years ago. But I think they just looked a little bit too good. Their appearance does not fit how they're acting for people who have been nearly starving to death. They look like actors. And in a story like this, I think atmosphere is everything. You have to really convince me that it's 5 years after a war and things are really, really bad. So I think that hurts it too. And I'm a little surprised at how they both react after they've been around, supposedly, we don't see any of it. They've been wandering around the landscape for years after the war, and yet they seem pretty surprised by everything they're finding. You'd think they'd be used to that by now. I mean, you go in the building and she finds that the despicable chicken in a can. But they don't look like, they look like they're surprised. And I can't imagine, they're veterans. And that makes me wonder why the writer would make it clear that it's been 5 years after the war. Why so many years after the war? Why not 6 months after the war ended? Or a year after? I don't see anything to gain by saying that it's 5 years after the war. And indeed, I think it hurts the story because I'm expecting to see something worse than I'm seeing. So if I were writing it, I would do maybe a year afterwards or something. Some other strange things. I mean, Charles Bronson, who, by the way, Lynn said that he was a very young Charles Bronson. I'm afraid not. He was 41 years old when he made this.
Was he really that old?
He certainly, yes, but Elizabeth Montgomery was only 28.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, yeah, 41. He
was 41. Well, I mean, I don't consider that old, especially at my age, but...
died 40 years later, so...
Yeah,
exactly.
She was nearly 38. She was 37.
I saw 28, unless I added it up wrong.
She was born in 1933.
Oh.
And this is 61.
Yeah.
That makes her 28.
Wait a minute, 33.
53. Well, she died when she was 65, so she died in 95.
Can't count.
Yeah, she was 28. But he, he looks like, it's strange because I would have thought that he was younger than that, too.
Yeah,
anyway,
it's like mid-30s, yeah.
After he goes into that building there, he shaves, like, oh, my God, I finally get to shave. But it's been 5 years. His beard ought to be down to the floor. I mean, I have more stubble on my face right now while I'm talking than he did after all those years wandering around, which is a little bit odd, too. Also in that scene, he takes water and he throws it on her. Please explain to me how after so many years, water did not evaporate. It's inside, not outside. So it's certainly not rainwater, and it's just a miracle. It's absolutely a miracle that water would be sitting there after so long in a little container. I don't know how you do that because water evaporates. Not after 5 years. There's not going to be water there. Many people are commenting about the chicken in the can, and it is disgusting. And it's kind of odd because everybody likes chicken. I like chicken in all forms, but there's something disgusting about that, and I think the reason is we're so used to seeing things in a certain way. And unless I'm missing something, I have never seen chicken in a can with bones attached to it. And I think that's what really makes it gross. Plus, imagine greasy, lukewarm chicken that comes out of the can. It's absolutely disgusting. And if they're lucky, they're not around today because it was just a report about a week or so ago in the news that they found that there are deadly chemicals in canned food, including arsenic. So they better be careful what they're eating there.
Good.
Yeah, very good. And then when I watch a movie or a TV show, I like to know what happened behind the scenes. And as everybody knows, actors, when they make a movie or anything, have to do scenes over and over and over again until they're right. They take multiple views of it, and the director's never happy, and you got to do it again and again and again. And they pick up that chicken. I guess it was Kentucky Fried Chicken. I think Kentucky Fried Chicken was around in the early 60s. And they take it out of that can, and they actually eat it. They didn't spit it out or anything. They're actually eating it. And how difficult it can be to be an actor and having to do that over and over and over again. I certainly don't envy anybody that does that. So these are kind of things that hurt the episode, but I will give it credit for one. Overall, I give it credit for taking a different view of war, because usually when you see war stories, they're too obsessed with either telling the story about the war itself, or when they do an after story, it's either that the world is completely devastated and destroyed, somebody wins, somebody loses, but they very rarely take a look at what happens to the to anybody that may be left behind, such as they did in Time Enough at Last. I gave Twilight Zone credit for taking a look at that the way most movies and TV series about war don't. It's either somebody wins, somebody loses, but there figures to be, as has already been said on the show here, that there figures to be somebody basically left behind. As far as the acting is concerned, it's not easy to do a story in which there's no dialogue, because dialogue is the one thing that you use to show emotion. So you got to give them credit for that, for being able to look realistic. I basically like this story. I gave it a 4, and I wouldn't change that any. I don't quite think it comes up to being a classic, but it is unusual. Actually, my favorite scene in the entire thing is when he first meets her, and she starts throwing things at him before he has a chance to do anything. It reminds me of some dates I had when I was a teenager that started out badly. Yeah. And kind of scared me. Other than that, the ending, it's a love story. It's interesting at the beginning, but it kind of fades away as it goes along. There's really nothing left to say except they hate each other. I don't think you can win over a woman's affections simply by handing her a wedding dress or a fancy gown and telling her to put it on. It's a little too simplistic. It's true, they've only got each other. One thing I did like that he said at the beginning of the story, when he said to her, "I can't see any reason for us to fight anymore other than the fact that we're wearing different uniforms. And it's too bad that human beings don't think about that before the war starts, and a lot more people might be alive today." So, because in reality, that's about all it amounts to. People wearing different things or coming from different countries and starting killing each other for absolutely no reason that makes any sense. So at the end of it, it's a nice little ending, maybe a little too simplistic and a little too easy. I said the same thing about Henry Bemis back in Time Enough at Last, which is that they're looking at a lot of trouble. I mean, after a war, you got to find things to eat and water to drink. What about water? You can't survive without water. You better find some water somewhere. And they kind of wander away, and it's been the cutesy little ending with them doing that. But I will say this, I thought it's too bad that before they walked away with each other, they didn't find a lawyer who was wandering the landscape, because given their initial meeting, I think they're going to need him eventually somewhere down the line. So
the combat boots were a nice touch. You have to say that.
Yeah.
Dress and combat boots.
It might have been nice. Of course, you couldn't do it because that was a nuclear war back in Time Enough. It would have been nice if they had met Henry Bemis somewhere along the line and the three of them had wandered away together.
He could adopt them. Henry could adopt them.
I'll keep it at 4. Okay, Lynn, back to you.
Okay, and before I turn this back, because I want Robert to finish what he wanted to say, but I would have to say that one of my favorite scenes in this, and it was at the end, and again, this goes back to Elizabeth Montgomery and having to carry the show with just facial expressions, mannerisms, when she goes up to him at the end, and he's coming out of that building, and he's yelling at her to go away, get away from him. The look on her face, I mean, just that the eyes that are saying, "Please forgive me," that look on her face was priceless. And she was great at that. She was good with those expressions. She's looking up at him saying, "Please, I'm sorry, please forgive me, don't send me away." That was an absolutely priceless look on her face. And,
yeah,
and I love that.
If she had just twitched her nose, she could have fixed everything.
Go ahead, Robert. I'm sorry.
Well, she had a whole night to think about that, too. I imagine if you remember that scene, how uncomfortable it was when she was trying to sleep. So,
yeah, there was a rifle on her shoulder, yeah.
I know. Yeah. So was that what you mentioned before I started breaking up real bad about that?
Let me see. Before, it was basically about God, what were we? Gosh, now I forget what we were talking.
We lost about a minute of you.
Yeah, I know. For some reason, you were breaking up real bad. I don't know what's going on with Blink tonight. It's really has its ups and downs, and it's very much what it was a couple of weeks ago when I tried to do a show, and it just, for life of me, I could not get through.
I would like to welcome Felix. Hi, Felix. It's good to have you here again, as always.
Hi, Felix. Yeah, I would try TalkShoe, but every time I do TalkShoe, it sounds like I'm underwater when I talk, so I try to avoid TalkShoe.
You sound great right now. Yeah, you sound fine.
Yeah, it sounds more of a bandwidth issue than the actual software, I think.
Well, one of the points I was bringing up was it very much reminded me of apocalyptic stories, and you know, later on that we get with Damnation Alley is a good one with Jan Michael Vincent and George Peppard about nuclear war that tilts the axis and causes strange weather, and of course flesh-eating cockroaches.
Multiple warhead strike confirmed. Retaliatory strike on advisement.
Hostile missiles heading to major U.S. population targets. Launch retaliatory missiles. All enemy targets.
You have seen great adventures. Now you're about to live one. Damnation Alley. Everything man remembers is gone. Everything he has achieved is forgotten. Every place he has lived has become a wasteland, desolate, barren. And these five survivors may be the only humans left alive. Together, they will attempt a journey into the unknown. Their courage and the instinct to live could carry them safely through the hell that lies ahead. The devastation of man and the mutations of nature gone wild. And somehow, they must endure this journey through the nightmare of what we once knew as Earth. Somehow they must survive this journey through Damnation Alley. Starring Jan Michael Vincent, George Peppard, Dominique Sander, Paul Winfield, Jackie Earle Haley. Produced in the magic of Sound 360. More than a motion picture, an adventure you'll never forget.
Always a favor among sci-fi people. Has to have some kind of alien creature that's not so alien but earthbound that actually turns into a mutant lobster or some strange thing. But you get that. You get the environmental disaster type, apocalyptic type movie, which is The Stand is pretty much Stephen King about the virus that's let loose over the world, but it focuses just on that one certain area and the struggle with good and evil in that one.
From Stephen King, the master of suspense, comes his all-time bestseller.
Containment breach! We've had a major containment breach! Use the manual gate override, Captain! Do it now!
Deadly virus released by a government mistake. A frantic military willing to stop at nothing to cover up the terrible truth.
The so-called super flu does not exist.
What did you do? What did you people do?
As the plague sweeps out of control, a nation erupts, society crumbles, the end is here.
The monster's here! The doctor is here!
Now, all that remains, the demon, the prophet, and those chosen to survive. Drawn by dreams of an old woman.
You'll be coming along to see me, won't you, Larry?
The chosen ones stream to Colorado to find their dreams are real.
Help us to be true, dear Lord. Help us to stand.
Las Vegas, an army of darkness assembles, controlled by dreams of their leader, Randall Flagg.
Go for it.
Do it, Harold, do it!
It's time to make your stand.
The ultimate stand against the forces of evil. Molly Ringwald, Rob Lowe, Laura San Giacomo, Gary Sinise, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Ruby Dee, and Jamie Sheridan. Stephen King's The Stand.
And then
I think that's course, what happened. I think that's what happened to Keith Richards.
I thought it was Mick Jagger, but
you know. One or the other.
One or the other. Or Mad Max, which seems to be one of the most popular, and, you know, shooting off the two movie sequels, Road Warrior and Thunderdome. One of the ones that was always brought up and very interesting in the fact that that wasn't originally Mel Gibson's voice in the first one, because during that time, starting out, he had such a thick Australian accent, and since it was filmed in Australia, they had to dub his voice in the first movie, but I guess he was a little bit better in Road Warrior.
Somewhere on the abandoned highways of tomorrow, where law is another word for vengeance,
I'm gonna blow him away.
Where justice is a forgotten memory. And order lies shattered in the ruins of civilization.
I am the Rocker!
Somewhere up ahead, a hero is waiting. Max. The crack interceptor for the main force patrol. His power is a badge of bronze.
The Night Rider. Remember him when you look at the night sky.
We know who you are, Bronze!
We remember the Night Rider!
His friends, where does the rat get you?
Get out of here.
His only weapon, 600 horses of fuel-injected machinery. His mission is a non-stop, high-torque pursuit of speed-crazed bandits.
Bronze, kill our pride.
I'm scared, thief. I'm beginning to enjoy it.
Down the top shelf! You're a winner, Max!
Crazy about you.
We know who you are!
They've broken his wife. They've killed his best friend.
People don't believe in heroes anymore.
They've pushed him too far.
We're gonna give them back to heroes!
Mad Max.
I mean, you can name bunches of apocalyptic-type movies, and that's one thing that I enjoy about too, is that it does set up for years down the road. Maybe looking at it differently, if I was growing up during the time this aired, like Bobby, maybe I would have a different approach and maybe not as delightful with it now as maybe if I was watching it during that time and really didn't have anything to compare it to. I mean, you know, a lot of these Twilight Zone shows, you know, you got about 20 or 30 years of films and TV series you can compare to a lot of these episodes today. Jeremiah is another one about apocalyptic. It was a series that I think ran a couple of seasons. You have Red Dawn. So, I mean, there's like, you know, that's more of an invasion movie than anything. I mean, there's like a lot of things that you can name out there. But
James Earl Jones was in Red Dawn, wasn't he?
What now?
James Earl Jones, he was in Red Dawn, wasn't he? Or am I mistaken?
Patrick Swayze was Red Dawn, wasn't
Patrick
it?
Swayze, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I thought
Patrick
James
Swayze.
Earl Jones was in that.
C. Thomas Howe is in that as well.
Oh, okay. I got the wrong movie. Yeah. Here I am mistaken.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I wouldn't doubt James Earl Jones is probably in an apocalyptic movie somewhere out there.
Oh,
it
I'm sure.
It seems to be one of these things of status that these actors have to either be in an Irwin Allen disaster film or an apocalyptic movie to make their careers. So.
Exactly.
But very much 5 out of 5. I give for this. I still consider it far better than, as I said earlier, King 9. Most definitely an improvement.
The canned chicken was better than King 9 will return.
Well, poor Colonel Sanders probably turning in his grave, you know, right now, you know, knowing his chicken being canned and being eaten 6 years later. Things are looking good.
Good. Andy Griffith, you ain't good, Ampy. And Felix. Felix gives it a 4 to a 4.5. Between a 4 and a 4.5. Thank you, Felix, for your vote on.
I hailed the mic long now. I'm going to pass it over to Dave because I imagine Dave has a lot of good things to say.
I'm sure he does, as always. Yeah.
I'll try and make one or two comments. Yeah. I liked it. I mean, it was very frugal in the dialogue department, as has been stated. I know it's been mentioned that this is the first episode of series 3, so but mm-hmm. I think that needs restating. First aired on the 15th of September 1961. And these were two rising stars. Just to put that in perspective, as I say, this went out on the 15th of September 1961. In October of 1960, Charles Bronson had just made it sort of big time in The Magnificent Seven, which was his breakthrough role, as it were. And Elizabeth Montgomery, around the same time, October the 13th, so they both came to prominence almost at the same time 1 year earlier. She won an Emmy for being a guest star on The Untouchables, the Rusty Heller story, which in actual fact for The Untouchables was their Series 2 season opener. So the last credit she'd had on TV, she'd been an Emmy Award-winning actress. So, obviously, these two, just as well, there were only two in the cast. They probably couldn't afford much else. They were two rising stars. Now, admittedly, Charles Bronson's career faltered a little bit from there because it was only a few years later, and I think it was probably The Dirty Dozen, about 5 or 6 years later, where, you know, he actually... really got on. Well, he was in Four for Texas in 63, but really it was a slow build. And then of course it was the Death Wish series that got him his own thing, and he did Mr. Majestic and a few things like that. But basically
and he fell in love and married a fellow actress, Jo Ireland, who unfortunately died of cancer years later.
Well, she was actually David McCallum's wife at the time. But interestingly, about you talk about these two, would they be suitable to meet if they're the last human race? She married 4 times, he married 3 times, so that obviously wasn't an issue with them, but that's of course in their personal life. You're quite right. I mean, it does put demands on the actors, that lack of dialogue. The chicken, I think what that was in the tin, it's what we would call in the UK jellied chicken. That, in other words, the drumsticks are packed into that, and then it's filled with the sort of jelly from the chicken. And
oh,
that would...
God,
no, 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 no. You don't eat the jelly. You don't eat. You don't eat. No, no, no. You don't eat the jelly. That acts as like
a preservative for the chicken, yeah.
And stops it from drying out. That's why when you see him pull it out, it looks as though it's got gunja. Looks as though it's got axle grease around it. But that's...
I'm not going to be able to eat dinner tonight, you
realize? But the point is, that's probably one thing that would last a long time. And it's obviously, although they, as you say, and I just want to not take issue with Bobby, but when he said he didn't know why it was so long after, I think that was very particular. He says very early on in the narration, it's the first day of the sixth year. That people have come into this thing. And of course, I thought that was a reference to Genesis. And it's, if you were such a religious person like myself, you would know that on the sixth day, you know, God created all the animals and beasts and man in his own image. And then on the seventh day, he rested. So I think it was very particularly the first day of the sixth year. It was supposed to be the sixth day of God creating. And I think that was for the creationist people to keep them happy. And the idea is that, you know, the human race would be starting in the sixth year with these two. And they can't explicitly state that, but I think it was implicitly implied by setting it first day of the sixth year. So that's it. And I do agree, though, about the cast having to do these retakes and keep eating that. Robert will know one of the Doctor Who, the John Sim, who played the Master in the End of Times Part 1 and 2. This is a person who's regenerated, but his regeneration has gone wrong, and he's consuming energy at a fantastic rate. And so he has to virtually eat a whole turkey on screen. You know, a sort of a 12-pound turkey he has to eat. So if he did that take a few times, you can imagine it being quite difficult for the actor and actresses.
Avoided the turkey at Thanksgiving. He probably just had ham, I imagine.
I agree as well, as the two of them looked remarkably, you know, stiff upper lipped and, you know, very much. I mean, I think the thing about him shaving, I realise he should have had more of a beard, but I think that was probably, you know, part of his military background, that even though there were no officers around, he's expected to keep himself smart. I think with the Elizabeth Montgomery character, more so then, I think, than now, young actresses were trained to, you know, stand upright and be very sort of very good posture, as it were. And when you see her with that posture, that, again, I suppose you could say it's a militaristic bearing, but it does clash with the fact that they've been living rough for 5 or 6 years. You would have thought more of those things that they were hanging on to would have perhaps been taken away from them. You would have thought they'd look a little bit more weather-beaten, a little bit more... it would have been almost better if he'd arrived there like a wild man and then perhaps found a better looking uniform on one of some dead body somewhere and gone in and shaved himself, you know. So when they first see each other, they're almost like cavemen seeing each other, and then they both respectively you know, pass a mirror or something and then realize, you know, that they've got to maybe not for sexual reasons, maybe to sort of show that their side is weathering the war better than the other, and so for morale purposes almost go and spruce themselves up, not in the dress, still in military uniforms, and then only later go into civvies. So I thought it was very good. I'd certainly give it 4 out of 5. And I think as a season opener, it promised great things. So all in all, a lot of things. And I'll play one little bit of music, if I may, because every time I see Charles Bronson, this music comes into my head.
Okay. That's great. That's really great.
Just a few seconds. Yeah, because it then goes into the... And I better stop it there. Of course, the theme music to The Magnificent Seven.
Exactly.
Which is actually one of my top five films, I think.
That's an excellent movie. That is great. I'm glad you played that.
But yeah, excellent thing. And the casting of it. I mean, I agree that Charles, I mean, I think he was around the 40 mark. But of course, one assumes, again, it's supposed to be 6 years after the war. And so if the war had gone for many years, he may have joined it as a young soldier. So mm-hmm. it wasn't that believable that he would be of that sort of age at this stage, you know, in the storyline.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It would make sense. Well, that, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I don't think they looked, I mean, in this episode, I don't think they looked that far apart in age.
No, no. And about the water, I mean, before, I mean, I was thinking, why waste the water? But that water was scum-laden water, and because he takes the stuff and then throws it over her face. But there was vegetation around, so we assume that, you know, we're not in, you know, not totally arid. There is rainfall and that. Maybe that bucket had got filled with a, you know, there's a hole in the roof and rainwater's come in and. I mean, if it were that desperate, he would have tried to drink it, or he would have tried to find some muslin or something to sort of, you know, clarify the water to be able to drink it.
I think it would have made Bobby happy if it would have rained that night that she was by herself and actually seen the water coming through the roof and into the sink. Frank would have solved it for him.
Is that true, Bobby?
No, I just think it's ridiculous. They're inside. They're not going to find any water inside.
If the buildings are derelict, they've been abandoned. The whole place was like a tumbleweed town, wasn't it?
Well, it was, yeah.
It was kind of a stretch.
It's just like rubble and everything. But you notice, though, they didn't drink any water. I mean, never did you see them drink anything. So I guess, you know, they didn't want to stretch it that far. But anyway, it looks like everybody's giving it between a 4 and a 5. So, you know, I'm happy about that because this was a really good episode. And I'm glad that they started season 3 with this episode. Aren't you? I mean, Robert, what do you think?
Most definitely. I've been saying a vast improvement from, like I said, season 3 seems to have some pretty good stories coming up. And mm-hmm. this is where I kind of deviate from what you and Bobby and others think of certain episodes. The Passerby is a good example of one that'll be coming up in the future where I kind of have a different take on that than what you guys would.
There were differing views on that. But,
well, I'm glad to hear that because I'm not going to have anything to say about that at all. So.
Oh, yeah.
You can speak for both of us. That's fine.
He always says that, but he has plenty to say. But no, I agree, and I think that I do like the idea that he started season 3 with this episode. It was a good way to do it, and I think this did keep people interested.
I mean, you got It's a Good Life coming up, which is another wonderful story.
Oh, absolutely.
As well. We end with the changing of the guard, which is Pussett. That's not a bad one either.
Donald Pleasance. Yeah, I just watched that the other night on MeTV, and I always enjoy that episode. I really do. And you know what? A long time ago when we were doing Night of the Meek and we were talking about that, people kept saying, did Rod Serling do any other Christmas episodes? And no, he actually didn't. But yes, he did. Changing of the Guard takes place. It never aired during Christmas. It aired in actually the summer, like June or July of the year third season. Yeah, it aired in the summertime, but it was a Christmas themed episode because for Christmas break. Yeah.
There's one more fact I was going to mention. I forgot, and that is that. The director of this episode, Montgomery Pittman. This episode aired in the 15th of September, 61. He died of cancer in 62. June 26, 6 months later, the director was dead.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. How old was he?
He was born in 1917, died in 62. I'm not trusting my maths tonight. So that's 45, is it?
Wow. I had no idea he died that young. Jeez, it's almost as bad as Charles Beaumont. He died in his 30s. Terrible. Well,
we have another Christmas one we forgot to mention, too. It's towards the end called Five Characters in Search of an Exodus.
Yeah, but of course, you know, that one only only shows the very, very last scene. You know, like mm-hmm. the very last scene where she's ringing the bell and, you know, and you have the bin there. But with Changing of the Guard, it is actually a Christmas-type episode because it takes place during Christmas. They sing Christmas carols at the end. So, yeah, I mean, he didn't do just one Christmas episode. He had other holiday-themed episodes, so that's cool. But anyway, our next episode is going to be on the 17th of December,
yep.
And that will be The Arrival. And I am so
do
sorry.
My lurch thing.
Everybody a big breath. Well, Robert, who is the guy that stars in that? I always forget to check that.
Oh, I forget to. Says how much I know. Or really remember
Grant Sheckley.
Yes, thank you, Grant Sheckley. Yes, yes. Well, no, wait. That's the character, isn't it? Or is that the guy that stars in it? Is that the guy?
Harold J. Stone.
Harold
is it,
J. Stone. Thank you.
Playing Grant
yeah.
Sheckley. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Harold J. Stone. Thank you, Dave. Yeah. So that will be on Saturday, December 17th. And we will be doing that one. Now, I do want to ask Robert and Dave something. The next show after that would be New Year's Eve. Do you guys normally do a show on New Year's Eve? Or?
I probably won't be around. We're having trouble with ours, the Cult and Collective, because we record on a Sunday. And this year, Sunday is both Christmas Day and New Year's
yep.
Day. So
right.
We've got to decide. We probably will skip. Mind you, as... doing all these podcasts, they might be glad of us giving them a break. But
yeah,
I mean, I think with the Twilight Zone being fortnightly anyway, I don't think it's not as though it's a weekly thing that people, you know, are. I think if you drop one out and came, I mean, it's your show, but
I know. I mean, we've missed when Bobby and I got married. It was between Christmas and our marriage. We missed 4 weeks. We had to go off.
Yeah, I threw in a couple commentaries. So
commentaries, and I did speak in Time Enough at Last, yeah. So
make the next show January 14th.
There you go, and I'll throw in a commentary of two somewhere
okay,
there.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so December 17th will be The Arrival, and then the next show will be the 14th. You want to go the 14th?
Right.
Is that okay with you, Robert?
Of January? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So
like I said, I'll do a commentary to fill in that space that will be off at Christmas Eve because I have people come over too. So I think we're all going to be busy those 2 weeks.
All right. Cool. So January 14th. So, you know, but we've got the show on the 17th. So we'll worry about that then. Okay. So December 17th, Saturday, we will see everyone here for The Arrival, I hope. I hope you all will arrive.
If my plane ain't late, I'll try to make it in as quickly as possible.
Yes, and try to if you can't get it, get on that Phantom plane and just get so stick your hand.
I'll ask Wonder Woman if I can borrow her invisible plane.
It was King Nine or whatever it was called.
Which one?
Oh, geez, can't trust that
King
one.
Nine.
King Nine. Oh my God. Yes. Yeah.
I go to room 22.
Oh, yeah, room 22. I think the canned chicken is better than all of this. All right, guys. Well, we will see you back on the 17th of December. So everyone have a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you then. Bye.
Yeah, nobody here but us chickens.
But us chickens, us canned chickens. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
An actor is all Elizabeth Montgomery ever wanted to be, and she succeeded as few in Hollywood ever do. She died today of cancer at age 62 in her Los Angeles home, surrounded by her family.
Once upon a time, there was a typical American girl.
It has been more than 30 years since Elizabeth Montgomery began twitching her nose and making things happen. As Samantha the Witch in a long-running series, Bewitched, Elizabeth created one of television's most memorable characters. It was a part she recalled with affection for E.T. several years ago.
I knew that people liked it because we kept doing it. It never occurred to me that it was going to be as enormous a hit as it is.
You're a witch!
She could use the present tense because even today, Bewitched is a hit on Nickelodeon.
It was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience, and it also allowed me the luxury of being able to sit back and say, okay, now I'm going to wait, and I hope that I have a career.
My ballpark.
Elizabeth Montgomery didn't have to hope very much.
You play by my rules or you're out of the game.
She played opposite Kirk Douglas and Amos in The Awakening Land. She took the role of a pioneer.
Jenny, you and Axe take Sully up to the loft.
Elizabeth Montgomery's acting career had extended almost the entire life of television itself. One of her early roles was on the legendary Twilight Zone. It was a part opposite Charles Bronson where she spoke just one word.
Krasny.
But after Bewitched, there were TV movies like A Case of Rape, The Legend of Lizzie Borden, Mrs. Sundance, and The Victim. She had no real explanation for her enduring popularity with television audiences.
I guess they get familiar with you, but then again, I'm as I said, you know, I kind of like to throw them curves every once in a while, but I think they like that.
So in recent years, there were films like Byline, Edna Buchanan, Sins of the Mother, and With Murder in Mind, co-starring her longtime companion, actor Robert Foxworth.
Why do you stay with me?
But even with her huge body of work, Elizabeth Montgomery will always be remembered as Samantha.
And Hollywood has lost another veteran. Actor Charles Bronson died of pneumonia over the weekend at the age of 81. NBC's George Lewis has more.
Charles Bronson started out as a coal miner in Pennsylvania and went on to become one of the screen's top tough guys. He got into acting on a chance encounter.
Yes. I met a man in a gym who said, Jesus, you know, I go to an acting class. He said, you ought to be an actor. He says, why don't you come to class with me? It was one of those things.
Known for his rugged, unconventional looks, Bronson, born Charles Bushinsky, was one of 15 children in a Lithuanian immigrant family.
What do you want me to do, evaporate?
He began his movie career playing character parts and villains.
Igor is working on a model of his head.
His big break came in 1960 in The Magnificent Seven.
Crazy kid, you might have been hurt.
So might you.
It's not the same thing. This is my work.
That was followed by action roles in The Great Escape and The Dirty Dozen. After several years in Europe building a name for himself, Bronson returned to the U.S. where he made his most controversial film, Death Wish, in 1974. A movie about vigilante justice widely criticized for excessive violence. Bronson, who was reportedly suffering from Alzheimer's disease, he was 81. George Lewis, NBC News, Los Angeles.